Welcome to the Sounds of Success. Brought to you by the National Association of Professional Martial Artists. This audio magazine is a tool for generating profitable ideas and for taking your business to new levels of excellence and performance. Now here's your host, Mark Graydon.
Hello, NAMA members. Toby Milroy here again with your monthly marketing minute for December. And obviously, as December comes into focus, many martial arts school owners are looking towards vacation time and looking towards taking a well-deserved, needed rest for a couple of weeks before the new year gets kicked off. However, at the very same time, we do have a unique opportunity during December that does present the potential to be a big revenue driver and a big renewal driver in our schools. And this is a technique that we use in all of our franchise locations and in many of our high-level Inner Circle Peak Performer member locations very, very effectively. And it's an opportunity to generate as much initial cash and as many renewals or upgrades as many schools do in several months all at once. Using this very effective strategy. And basically, it works like this. As the new year ends, we all know that next year we are going to have an increase in our rent in our commercial locations. Our insurance premiums are going to go up. Our cost of goods sold is going to increase. The cost of virtually everything in the martial arts school is going to be more. Every piece of doing business next year is going to be more expensive, virtually guaranteed. So this and in reality, people know this in their own lives as well. They know that every year the cable bill goes up a little bit and the electric bill goes up, you know, etc. So this is a unique opportunity for us in our martial arts schools to build a system that will help us clean up any lingering renewals or upgrade prospects who may be qualified for our upper level program, but for one reason or another haven't chosen to invest in it or haven't chosen to get involved in our higher level program. And this is a unique opportunity during this time of the year to give them a real finite deadline and give them urgency to be able to take advantage of this year's prices before next year the new price increase and the new prices take effect. And our strategy on that is tested and proven, and year after year after year, our schools are generating as much revenue and as many renewals in 6 or 7 weeks than in most cases most schools do in 3, 4, or 5 months. So this is certainly something that's a very useful technique. And basically it works like this. You take all of the students in your school who you feel are qualified and who have in fact accomplished the goals that they were meant to accomplish in their trial or their orientation or their basic program, and basically group them all together in your database and group them all together as a function of communicating to them, and communicate to them how you really feel that their participation in the school is fantastic, their level of commitment thus far has been exactly what you expected, and they've accomplished all the goals that you had laid out for them, and you feel that they're a great candidate for this higher level program, this master club or this leadership team or this black belt club, whatever the phraseology and the structure you use in your particular upgrade program, your particular renewal program. And I really wanted to take this opportunity to speak to you now because waiting now is a very expensive thing to do. Obviously, each year we have a tuition increase in our school in order to keep pace with expenses. And I wanted to double check with you to make absolutely sure that I gave you every opportunity to participate in this new higher level program before the prices increase in January, thereby saving you $3,000, $5,000, $7,000, $10,000 by locking in your, you know, this year's prices today rather than deciding later to say yes and having to pay the additional premium. So this is an extremely effective technique that has been proven successful in dozens and dozens and dozens and hundreds of locations all across North America and the world. So certainly it's something that we should be focused on in December in our own academies. Secondarily, I think it's very important that you as a school owner do not get in the frame of mind that since parents and families and adults are in the Christmas shopping mode, that they're spending all of their money on everything other than things that you offer in your school, when in fact it's quite the opposite. If you have the vocabulary and the ability to get in front of your students, they are going to be out buying Christmas gifts. They are going to be out shopping for friends, family, and their own children. And what better opportunity is there for you to provide some solutions to those shopping needs, which is another argument for getting happily involved in our master club or our leadership program now. Therefore, you can have this big box of leadership material, curriculum, books, equipment, whatever it may be, to put under the tree. What a fantastic investment. You know, this training may be the one gift you give him this year that he'll have for the rest of his life. It won't be like the toy that is attractive for a couple of weeks and then starts to gather dust through non-use. These are skills that your son or daughter will take with them for the rest of their life. So certainly this is a unique, amazing opportunity in December to really focus on cleaning up any existing lingering renewals and really starting off the year with flush cash reserves and with a nice rest between December and just after the new year so that you can hit the ground running full speed in January. So thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I truly hope to see you at our spring event. Thank you so much for your time. I'll speak to you next month.
Hi, Stephen Oliver here. I'm glad to have you. We have a very special guest, a friend of mine, Keith. What do we go back now? 25 years or something like that, I believe.
Been a long time.
But, Yeah, a long time. I'm celebrating the 26-year anniversary of Mile High Karate this week, and you're celebrating your 30-year anniversary this year in owning that school. And the school I know predates your ownership. So you've been essentially in the same place in Ann Arbor, Michigan, for a long, 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 long time, and have achieved enormous success there. Little bit of background for our listeners. Our special guest today is Professor Keith Haffner. He's a 7-3 black belt in Taekwondo. He's been, as I just said, operating a very, very successful school in Ann Arbor, Michigan, for over 30 years. And Keith, you know, one of the, you know, the interesting background, and I'm not sure we both enjoy sharing this, but we obviously met through the ESC Board of Directors in the early 80s, but I think we bonded over both being broke at the same time.
That's right. I remember.
And yeah, it was truthfully a spectacular experience, and a spectacular learning experience, although it never feels that way at the time. I'm sure you would agree with that.
Very
And
much.
I remember some of our conversations with Nick on how you recover from that, and our conversations about cash is king and one thing or another. And I'll tell one of our favorite little stories is in the early 90s, in the midst of the past recession, which interestingly looks just about exactly like this one. We had tons of bank failures and savings and loan crisis, and you know the auto companies in jeopardy and all of that same stuff. And of course, you feel that more acutely being in Ann Arbor, which is a suburb of Detroit. But we had this little lobster bet. Remember our lobster bet?
Who
And
could forget?
so, yeah. So if I recall correctly, the situation was we bonded by both being broke at the same time, and I was tickled to death that I like took off a little faster than you did. So we had this little lobster bet on who had the best numbers at the end of each year, and I soundly kicked your butt for about 3 or 4 years, and then all of a sudden you had this epiphany, and I'll let you explain this small school to big school epiphany for everybody. You got tired of referring to as a good small school or something like that.
Well, we had been a small school for many, many years and really kind of always thought of ourselves that way. And going way back, I had been a multi-school owner. I had three full-time schools way back when I really didn't know what I was doing. But as time went by and I got more and more tired of being broke, I started to develop this vision of just having a big single school and having everything right there under one roof. And when that vision started to become clear, that was when things really started to change for me.
Yeah. I think you said something there that was pretty important, which is when you got tired of being broke. And I know what we see a lot among martial arts school operators is they accept being broke, and so at a certain point, they just think that their lot in life, since they've decided to teach martial arts for a living, and somehow think of it as kind of a calling, like being a priest or something. They go from being broke and being annoyed with the idea to being broke and accepting it, and never make that epiphany or that breakthrough that you did, which is, you know, get tired of being broke and step things up and make things happen.
I remember so clearly there was a time when I had started to learn some better ways to do things, and but I was making those choices really slowly and kind of just picking and choosing what I was going to do. And I remember a point where in my study with, you know, you yourself and Steve LaValle were so far ahead at that time. And after studying what you guys were doing, at one point just deciding, I'm going to make whatever changes are necessary to become successful. I don't care what they are. I don't care how I feel about these things. I don't care how they seem to me intellectually. I'm just going to model these behaviors. And that was really the breakthrough, because if I think about it, when you talk about the other school owners that are staying in the same place and have gotten used to being broke, I think it's kind of fear-based thinking, the fear of change. And once I just made a decision to let go of that, then it became really easy to implement and move forward.
Yeah, 'cause when you decided to implement, and that's the next piece of our little lobster bet, is when you decided to implement it, it seems like to me it was like 6 months later, all of a sudden you went from from the middle of the pack to the top of the charts. And I'm sure it wasn't quite that quick, but give everybody a perspective. You went from what type of total gross to what level of gross? How long did it take you when you made that decision?
Well, I'm like you. When I look back, it seems like almost like it happened overnight, but it was really spread out over a couple of years. Where we had gone from, 175, 200, 225 students to just under 800. And it was over about a 2 or a 3 year period, I think, that happened. When I look back right now and think about that explosive growth, it just seems really, really miraculous that it happened, because it seemed like it was overnight. But the truth is that we had worked really hard for a long time, planting a lot of seeds before that harvest came.
Sure, sure. Now, some people on the call are going to think that, and I don't know what kind of gross numbers you were doing before. Let me say, what was it, 20 to 30,000 a month before the growth spurt? Is that probably right?
We were more like 18 to 20,000 for a really
long
time. Yeah.
Okay. So you were in the 18 to 20,000 range, and I know some school owners aspire to that number.
Uh-huh.
And you know what? What I find difficult is, when I talk to school owners, it seems to me to be natural that 15 to 25,000 gross a month is kind of the minimum that you should accept. And obviously, then making a decision to really be successful, you can hit numbers that are way beyond that, obviously, as you've proven. What would you say to a school that maybe is 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 a month, and they think that that's, that they're struggling to be there?
A lot of times those owners, and I'm talking about people that, I talk with nearly every day, they tend to look externally. They tend to look at the economy. They tend to focus on their competitors. They tend to think about changes that they don't want to make. But when I look back on it, things did change externally for me, but the biggest thing that had to change was my thinking and my perception about what was possible for me. And when I got sick and tired of being sick and tired, then everything was open for examination and review.
Yeah.
And I really, I had the right kind of thinking to keep me at 18 or 20,000.
Right.
And what I had to do, when our school reached 100,000 and 105,000 a month, I had to, that took a different kind of thinking.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. And the and again, and you're throwing some numbers out there, but and I know behind the scenes, I mean, you've truthfully run for many, many, many years a school that's truly $1 million plus a year school, mm-hmm. and I know for many years 50% or so to the bottom line. And so, very impressive. And before they get the idea that, there's something spectacular on your location, why don't we describe your location for them?
Well, we are in a affluent city, and we are right downtown on Main Street, and it's a very popular part of town. There are restaurants and cafes everywhere you look. It's a very busy part of town. It is a nightmare to come down here and find a parking place. We are in the lower level. We've got about 8,000 square feet. It's hard to find. If you drive by, you won't necessarily see it. And if you see it, it might take you a while to find a place to park. And so I think our location is good for us in the sense that we've been here since 1974, and a lot of people do know where we are now. But I'm not sure that if you were just starting out from scratch, if it's the location that you'd pick.
No. And the way I've described it humorously to many people is you walk into a coffee shop and there's a hidden entrance before you get to the coffee shop so you can take a ride down into the dungeon. And now you're in the school. And you do have, quite a bit of square footage, which at 300 or 400 students wouldn't be necessary. at 800 students even. I've always thought that you had a lot more space than you needed. But the type of location that you're in lends itself to a rent that's manageable, and clearly your marketing budget and your payroll far exceeds your rent at any time in your history, I would assume.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So let's talk now, because again, you and I could spend a lot of time talking about how we learned how to market a school in the 80s and the 90s, but in 2009, 2010, and beyond, you and I both agree. We talked about this pretty extensively in the last couple of weeks. The market has changed. Clearly, the economy has changed. I think a lot of what has changed is not so much, the economic climate, but the environment that we're in dealing with a martial arts school specifically,
uh-huh.
and how our market responds to what we're doing. But our theme coming up in our next event is going to be, how things have changed in the current economy and how you cope with that. So let's talk about that. I know that in the early 90s, an awful lot of what I did and what you came to do is an awful lot of big media stuff. You know, in my case, I was running, which we still use from time to time, and it works. But we were using a 30-minute infomercial. We were doing a lot of TV advertising, 30-second spots on the broadcast channels. Well, harder for you to do since you're in the Detroit metro area. But a lot of newspaper ads and so forth. And frankly, over the last few years, and all in part blame it on the MMA trend. We can argue the point on what's caused it, but we both believe that the things you need to do to market a martial arts school today have changed dramatically, both from the way that our prospective students look at price and value, and the way they look for or don't look for a martial arts program specifically. What are your thoughts on that? What's changed over the last couple of years?
You know, I think it changes so fast that if somebody is not actively engaged in the business, and if they've been out of the business for 3 or 4 or 5 years, they've got no idea what it's like at the present date. You know, I look back at ads that I ran, and you were really helpful way back in showing me the right way to advertise the school. When I look back at those ads that pulled really well then, we run much more sophisticated, better marketing pieces now. But those lousy ads from 20 years ago pulled better. And
yeah.
The marketplace was different. I think what you've got now is a jaded, cynical consumer out there that we're trying to advertise to. And back 20 years ago, the martial arts were not, they hadn't reached the saturation point. And there were a lot of people that hadn't been exposed to it, and there was still some mystery and some curiosity about it. And certainly when I remember you jumping on the karate kid phenomenon, and you were the first one that I knew that really saw the opportunity in that, it was an innocent marketplace at that time. And so a lot of times you just could run an ad and say, hey, we're here and we've got karate, and it would work. But now it's a much more difficult terrain, I think, because anybody that has any interest in martial arts whatsoever has already been exposed to it. They've got a school right down the street from them. Some of the older kids have probably already been in martial arts. It's just kind of the post-martial art era of martial art advertising, and it requires an entirely different approach, I think.
Yeah, and I'll look at it from a different angle as well, which is the getting the attention of a consumer is so much more difficult now.
Uh-huh.
And when we were marketing heavily in the 90s, let's say it was TV advertising. I mean, it wasn't like it was pre-cable TV, but now there's 500 channels and there's uh-huh. DVRs and there's all that kind of stuff going on, and TiVo, and there's internet, all the different sources on the internet. There's so many different marketing messages that people are getting now. And, in my case, I used to buy, the full-page ad in the TV Guide in our daily newspaper.
which, by the way, went out of business a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
I remember 50 months a year I would have a full page ad, and I could count on 30 to 70 info calls a month per school, based upon that full page ad and based upon, you know, some TV advertising we were doing. And now, if I did the same level of budget in our remaining daily newspaper, I think it would probably be 10% of the response, and the cost would be, 10 or 20% higher. So we really have gotten to an age where people are, I think, not only cynical perhaps about our activity, but even they're cynical about all ad messages they see, and they have become increasingly immune to paying attention.
Absolutely.
So it's harder and harder and harder to get on their radar screen.
Yeah. Well, back then, in the era where we're talking about in the beginning, people still read actual newspapers.
Yeah, exactly.
And, we've had a one newspaper town all these years, and our newspaper just went out of business this spring and closed up shop. We're in a no newspaper town. I think there are plenty of opportunities for people that are nimble and can kind of see the picture differently. But the mass advertising that I did, I've long since abandoned. There was a time when we were mailing out 20,000 postcards a month to names that we had purchased, doing a lot of those really bulk kind of things, working with a mailing house, and just doing a lot of stuff that was big, but we were doing it in a hands-free way.
Yeah.
I just think the era of doing those kinds of things has really passed.
Yeah. Well, and so what happens now is it gets more and more important to have a relationship with the prospect,
mm-hmm.
more and more important to have their permission to communicate with them, more and more important to have something that's engaging and entertaining when it shows up in their mailbox. More and more important to have something that's out of the ordinary and out of the norm that's showing up to entertain and delight them. And more important down to the personal relationship of being in front of a group of people or an organization or having a referral or an introduction to get past that. So let's talk about it. And you mentioned something a minute ago. You said, which we've, of course, and we talked about this earlier today, is the industry is rife with people who are running around claiming to be experts.
Uh-huh.
And within our circle of friends, you mentioned Steve LaValle or Dave Kovar, and obviously you and I have worked together for 25 years, is there are a few people that we work with who are helping and teaching and doing a little bit of consulting or one thing or another with other schools. But the vast majority of people who are running around trying to teach people how to be successful seem to me to be in one of two categories. They're either they ran a school in the distant past and are still teaching what used to work.
Uh-huh.
And I know in my case, you and I are both making a six-figure income from running a martial arts school in 2009 and 2010. At least hopefully in 2010. And what I'm doing right now in the school that I still own and operate is much different than it was as if I had last owned a school 5 or 10 years ago. So if I'm now trying to teach people how to run a school like I used to do, I'm teaching them all the wrong things.
Right.
The other thing we've seen, and now you've done some coaching and masterminding too, is I've seen a lot of guys who I work with for 90 days or 6 months, and all of a sudden they decide that they're a genius. And a lot of the ones that I've seen were guys who were $8,000 a month, got themselves to 18 or 20 or 30, suddenly decide they were a genius, and then go teach other people how to do what I just taught them to do or what you just taught them to do.
Right.
And so there's kind of both ends of the spectrum. What's your thought on that?
Boy, if you look at the trade publications, it's. I think there are more consultants in the trade publications than anything else, aren't there?
Oh yeah. It's just constant. And again, most of them, have never really truly run a successful school over multiple economic cycles, over multiple climates. And many of them are just regurgitating what perhaps you taught them or I taught them or somebody else taught them, and they've never really gotten to much of a depth of understanding of it. You know, my biggest pet peeve is, and you and I were joking earlier that, you know, we used to be the young guys. You know, I remember in the, you know, in the 80s, I was getting pressed all over the industry, and I was 24. Within the ESC crowd, we were always the young guys. And, you know, and I don't think we're now the old guys. We're just, you know, we're in the middle of but unfortunately, there are a lot of guys in our kind of category who haven't run a school for years and, you know, and have put themselves up on a pedestal, and they're teaching other people, like, how to do something they don't really know how to do themselves because, you know, they haven't done it in the current market.
Right.
I think it's completely different. But let's go back to some of the things that maybe a quick bullet point list we could both teach people to do that might be effective to really get their school revving up and to hit the kind of numbers we're hitting.
You know, I think the thing that most people neglect, and there are so many turnkey products available for people that are looking for marketing help right now.
Yeah.
You read the trade publications, and there's all kinds of products that are available. And I think a lot of the school owners have sort of got this idea that you can just buy things and implement them, and they will produce info calls. And
yeah.
I'm not sure that it's that simple. What I tell people, if somebody were to ask me what's the best way to attract new clients, I would say it's all based on how many people you know.
Yeah.
And you used the word relationship a few minutes ago. I think that's the new model, is being active in your community and getting out there and meeting as many people as you can, because in a cynical climate like we've got right now, I think trust is everything. And being able to be a person of integrity who gets out there and shows a commitment to the community and gets to know people in person, I think that's the best way to build a business in this modern climate. And I'll point out that I think that's interesting, because it's actually the real old model before mass advertising was ever thought of. Back before television and back before direct bulk mail, you lived in a town and you had a business and you got out there and met everybody in town and established trust, and they came and did business with you. And I think that old model is the present model that people need to pay attention to.
Yeah, well, and I'll say it differently from my evolution, is the reason why I started shifting from owning a bunch of multiple locations with employees to owner-operators is we have all the turnkey systems, but the really be a key and integral part of the community and delve deep into the community organizations and anchor yourself deeply in all that is really only something that can be accomplished smoothly, in my belief, by an owner-operator.
Yep.
And it was, you know, increasingly difficult, as you know. In the early 80s, I was doing much of what we're doing now that's very effective. It was just problematic with people who are salaried employees versus who really had a vested interest and were an owner-operator for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Let me go back to something you said a minute ago. Buy and implement. They think they can then go buy a program and implement. Is, you know, I started calling that the magic pixie dust formula.
Uh-huh.
Is, you know, it seems like there are people who think they can subscribe and be a NAPNA member, or they can buy, you know, like my Extraordinary Marketing Box or something like that, and they sit it on the shelf and somehow think that they're going to be sprinkled with magic pixie dust and all of the world is going to change for them. And in our conversation, and it's really why on in the NAPNA tent, why our Peak Performers Program and our Inner Circle, and I know you do some things that are similar to that, which is really putting people in a room and helping them expand their horizons, see a belief system of what's capable. It's what you described from going from 18,000 a month to 100,000 plus a month. But really putting them in a room and helping them expand their belief system and expand their knowledge of what's possible, but then also get to an in-depth understanding of the behaviors that they can undertake to really improve their thing. And our evolution with NAPNA over the last couple of years has been from a box of marketing materials to a let's expand your thinking, let's show you what's possible, let's introduce you to success stories, and let's show you how you can learn all the tools that you need to go out and implement. Obviously, that's done much more effectively in a room with other people who are successful in a mastermind or in a personal learning environment. But I think you're exactly right. I mean, you can't go buy a box today and have that work. And certainly, although some of the mass media marketing with My Life Karate, we still use a fair amount of that stuff that works fine. But if we don't supplement it and really have the primary driver be what you're talking about, it doesn't work.
You know, the dot that needs to be connected with this, of course, is that it's the easiest thing in the world to upgrade your marketing. But what really needs to be upgraded is your classroom. And
yep.
If your marketing tells one story and the actual experience tells another story, you're sunk coming right out of the gate. And you know what's interesting is that everybody thinks their classroom is great. Have you ever had this experience? Anybody you talk to thinks that their classroom is never the problem.
Yeah.
But a lot of times, I think people have very ordinary execution in the classroom. And if you can plug into extraordinary marketing, but if you come in here and you come in and take a look and your karate class is just regular, there's a disconnect that's pretty hard to get over.
Yeah, well, I remember at a NAPNA World Conference probably 9 or 10 years ago, you know, I had everybody raise their hand who thinks that your classroom sucks. Of course, nobody raises their hand, martial artists tend to freely acknowledge that they're not great business people, they're not great marketers. In fact, they tend to be proud of the fact that they're not salesmen and they don't want to be salesmen.
Uh-huh.
But they all think that they're great teachers. And I've come to think about it this way: is it's not that they haven't gone through the mental transition of understanding that you have to go from student, quality athlete, to somebody who truly understands the curriculum, structures the curriculum properly, and then has the teaching methodology and pedagogy to chunk it properly and teach it properly. And so what they have a tendency to do is they think that since they're a great technician and that they create some students who have great technical skills, that somehow that means that they're a motivational and exciting and quality instructor. And, of course, you know, you and I know there's only really two measures that you can do in a martial arts school, right? There's what's your retention rate like, or your term I believe is quit rate, what's your quit rate like, and what's your renewal rate like.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I like to use the analogy of Harvard University. 3% of the people who enter as a freshman graduate as a senior. And most martial arts schools have a hard time going from March to April with that kind of retention rate.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the thing is, at some point you've got to be able to take those students and turn them into fans, turn them into advocates. And that really takes something extraordinary going on in the classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. You and I were just laughing a minute ago, but I Googled your name, my name, and Steve LaValle's name. And in every case, came up with two or three sites that are calling us McDojos, frauds, all kinds of other inflammatory names. Let's talk about that. In the average martial arts guy's perspective, which is not the people that we're talking to on the call. I mean, this is preaching to the choir. But the average technician, the average black belt or student's perspective is, they again think that perhaps that all martial arts is fighting. And I know that you and I disagree with that vehemently. But they also think that it's about the technical skill, not about the mental skills. And, of course, it's a combination of the two, in my belief. But let's talk about that. What are you really trying to accomplish with a student? If they start with you and accomplish second, third degree black belt, what do you want to have accomplished?
What I see, Stephen, is kind of a almost like a flip-flop of what a lot of people would see in the dynamic of a martial arts school. You've seen people that are too in love with their curriculum, and if the curriculum is the most important thing, and if the students can't execute the curriculum properly, then they are not valued in the same way. And so you've got these requirements in your school, and you're trying to develop a student's persistence and self-discipline and confidence so that he can do the requirements. And when I really started to see the potential of my martial arts school was when I started to see that we didn't need the persistence and the discipline so that the students could do the requirements. We only needed the requirements. We only needed the curriculum so that we could teach the students to be disciplined and focused and persistent.
Right.
And so it sounds minor, but it was really a huge switch where we went from teaching curriculum to actually teaching students.
Yep.
And when we did that, then everything that we did in our curriculum could be reevaluated according to how effectively it accomplished that purpose. And so truthfully, I want our students to look good in the curriculum because they're disciplined, because they're focused, because they're persistent. And I know that they will. And if you look at our students, I think they back that up very nicely. But it's never, the curriculum is never paramount. The student and the skills that are most important to them in their character are what's most important.
You know, you said a lot of things there that are very profound. And I'm going to try to paraphrase it. You said the curriculum is not paramount. Teaching the curriculum is not paramount. Teaching the student is paramount. And then the curriculum is a methodology to accomplish an outcome that's different than the physical outcome. So the curriculum is a methodology to create mental discipline, physical discipline, athletic skill, physical fitness, to accomplish focus and a sense of self-efficacy. Mm-hmm. So the student then feels like they're capable of achieving at a high level and other things in their life. And, you know, I think that's so important, and it's articulated better than I had previously, but it's what I see is the great fallacy of our UFC generation right now. Is if the example becomes learn how to be a great fighter in order to be a great fighter, but not be a good person, and not be disciplined and focused and capable otherwise, not be respectful and humble otherwise, not be also a great scholar, then we have great problems. And see, the thing that I loved about the Karate Kid era is the media messages that were going out to prospective students, to the general public, was one about this is a methodology. You know, it was the, you know, Danielson in the boat, and Mr. Miyagi says, why do we learn how to fight? And why do we learn karate? Do we learn karate to fight? And we said, no, we learn karate to learn how not to fight. You know, it was all of those great kind of corny lines, but it was implanting into the message of our market. And what I perceive to be the problem, I mean, it's the old Pogo quote, you know, I've seen the enemy and it's us, is we've allowed, and I don't mean you and me specifically, but our industry has allowed the general public perception to become that it's about who gets the knockout in UFC. And that's what martial arts is, rather than it's about becoming a scholar and moving on to West Point or Harvard or achieving at a high level in their job and being a deacon in their church, being a pillar of the community, which really is what you and I have always been about.
It seems like martial arts are like the only place where people don't get that.
Yeah.
You know, you went to a very tough university,
yeah,
and you had to acquire all kinds of skills so that you could learn the curriculum that they were teaching you. You had to be disciplined in your habits, and you were working, so you had to manage your time, and you had to develop all these character skills so that you could learn the Georgetown curriculum.
You bet.
But what's important now, the book learning you did then, or what you became in the process of studying that?
No, it's of course what you became in the process. I I haven't used econometrics or calculus or even the the philosophy classes since. But the process and the pressure cooker and the and their stated mission was teach you how to become a lifelong learner, and teach you how to pursue and learn whatever it is you needed to in your career as you adjust. And of course, we see that now. Somebody was saying recently, and I don't know if it's a fair statement or not, but in a standard career that people really have to either physically or at least on an intellectual level change everything they know about their career every 36 months. And I certainly think that's true in our school operations. I mean, there are some things that if you look back 25 years ago, we're still doing probably in very similar ways that we did 25 years ago, but the overall underlying structure of how we go about it on a day-by-day basis is radically different, has to be radically different this year than it was last year, and dramatically different last year than from 5 years ago.
That's right, yep. You know, if you think about what makes the classroom extraordinary, what you're trying to do is to create a series of challenges that cause a person's character skills to grow. You know, your persistence, my persistence, are just like our biceps and triceps. When you use persistence, it gets bigger, it grows, just like your muscles. And so let's say you have this student, and he doesn't have enough persistence in the beginning to learn the form or whatever it is you're trying to teach him, but you hang in there with him, and you encourage and inspire and motivate. And what happens in that student is that his persistence is forced to grow. Well, then a true teacher, his job is to then go back to that student and say, okay, Mr. Student, you've got three times as much persistence as you had a year ago. What do you have going on out there in the real world that's going to benefit from this? What does this added persistence mean for you in your other activities? What does it do for you at school or in your career? What kind of doors open up for somebody that's got way more persistence than everybody else? And that's what we see as really being the key to having an effective school, is having teachers who can cause that growth to happen in the students, but then are able to help them connect the dots outside of here so that they take their increased discipline, they take their increased focus and courage and responsibility out there and live their life in a different way because of it.
Absolutely. That's very important. And again, not to belabor the point, but let's go back to some very specific applications of that. And so we were talking about how most schools think they have a great floor, but really, in many cases, don't. And part of that is kind of an ephemeral concept of the mindset of the owner and what they think they're trying to accomplish. And of course, we've been talking about that pretty in depth. The next is truly the technical application of how people interact with other human beings, how they approach students in the classroom and their supports team, in other words, the parents and so forth. Let's talk about practical rubber meets the road. What can I as an instructor do today at 5 o'clock when I step up on the mat for my next class that's going to be more focused in this direction and less focused in a direction of purely teaching technical skills?
What I like to focus on is before it's even time to put somebody out there, to make sure you've got a person who takes these kinds of things seriously in their own lives.
Yeah, yeah.
And we talked before about how there are a lot of operators out there who are not concerned about improvement and are kind of small thinkers when it comes to looking at their own life's possibilities. So, of course, I think they're disqualified from teaching at this level at the beginning, aren't they? You know, there's no
way, absolutely,
since they don't see their own lives this way, that they can help another person become a possibility thinker.
Well, and I would say it a couple ways. One is I've always said that the staff, the main thing is the students all become like the instructor.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can give them a lesson of the week, and you can put a paragraph up that they read or give the students all a handout. And, of course, with NAPNA, we provide all those things for school owners. But truthfully, what it is that all of that stuff is wrapped around the fact that the students ultimately want to become and become like the instructor, or gradually they don't. And when you make the transition, and again, you make the transition from a $7,000 a month school operator to an $18,000 to $100,000 a month, is I think a lot of that is truly becoming focused on abundance, becoming convinced of your own capability to be both financially and emotionally successful, and truly becoming mentally and physically an embodiment of what we teach. And unfortunately, many school owners really are hypocrites, because they will buy into what we're saying. They'll buy into the fact that this is all about developing character, developing people. But in the bottom line is they're trying to develop success skills while feeling unsuccessful, being unsuccessful, and accepting failure as their lot. And
you know,
I think that's
what
really
you're describing right now also contains a clue to some of the criticism that we had talked about earlier, because I know you. If you were going to choose a teacher, you would want that person with the right kind of personality, and you wouldn't care too much about whether they were a third-degree black belt or a first-degree black belt or a brown belt, would you?
No.
You would rather have a person with a lower rank who embodied those skills, because we can teach them the curriculum skills to achieve a higher rank. But a lot of times, the critics, I think, are people that place value on rank and on tournament victories and things like that, where we're just looking for good people, people with good personalities and with strong character. And that's what we're trying to base our school on, is centered around those kind of people. Now, you and I have been in business for a long time. We do have high-ranking staffs, but that's not what's most important, I think, in putting a good teaching staff out there on the floor.
No, I mean, in our schools here in Denver, I mean, we have lots of 5th, 6th, 7th, 3 black belt head instructors, but we hire for character, hire for personality, hire for education and background, and then we can teach them the martial arts curriculum. I mean, the martial arts curriculum itself, and I'm not denigrating our own curriculum, anybody's martial arts curriculum can be taught to a relatively intelligent person. In a fairly short period of time. But the ability to interact properly with human beings, to just be a good human being, to be articulate and intelligent and be able to present things properly, no matter how scripted it is, and no matter how well-crafted and class-planned it is, really requires the right person.
So you said, what do we do at 5 o'clock today when it comes time to go out there? Here's what I want, Stephen. I want a teacher to go out there who is a fan of every single student in the class, who becomes their advocate. Now, this is not as simple as it sounds, and it's an easy thing to pay lip service to, but where this becomes difficult is this. The reality is that some students, they're a lot easier to be fans of than other students.
Yeah.
And what I'm after is a teacher that is going to love the unlovable, and become an advocate for the student who's kind of stinky, kind of unmotivated, sits in the back row and doesn't try very hard. I want them to pull for the people that are harder to like. And I think that's the first step. If you were just to say, what do you need somebody to do right now, today at 5 o'clock? And I would say it is to love the unlovable out there in the classroom. Because, you know, the truth is, if you've got a class of 25 kids, 10 of them, 8 of them, are going to be those kids that are kind of hard to get behind, but you need them. And that's really, you know, a lot of times schools are missing a lot of opportunity by just playing favorites and focusing on the students that are easy to teach and easy to like.
Well, and you can expand upon what you just said in two ways. One is the reason why all instructors think they're great is they listen to the top 10% who are in their face telling them how great they are.
Yes.
And so if you want a better barometer, take a poll of 100% of the students plus 100% of everybody who dropped out in the last 12 months.
Yes.
And, you know, and see what they think.
Yep.
The other piece of it, if our job is truly is to develop students and develop people, is, and if we're in the process of developing character, well, that implies is we take people who have low physical skill and create mediocre or high skill with them. We take people who come in without a lot of confidence and focus and discipline and develop them into people of decent or high discipline and focus and confidence. We take people of perhaps low character and mold them through the process into people of high character. And, you know, I've heard it described, which I think is accurate, is that most sports, what they do is they wash out everybody who's not a fairly high character and confidence in order to develop superstars among the ones who came to it with the right attitude and capabilities to begin with. That's not what we want to do.
Absolutely. One of the mistakes that the critics make is that they assume that everybody's going to look the same.
Yeah.
And I don't think that standard is realistic or desirable.
Well, no, and what you don't want to do is you don't want to weed out the ones who are awkward.
Right.
Because they're going to have a mediocre sidekick when they get to their black belt rather than a vertical sidekick when they get their black belt.
Yep.
And, you know, I've said it this way, is that any instructor can find a few people who are genetically gifted, who come to it with the capability of being a superstar.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've seen some of the worst instructors in the world produce the one national point fighting champion or the one national forms champion. Not because they're a great instructor, but because that person, that student, came to them with unnatural genetic physical gifts and with focus and discipline that was pre-existing.
And the teacher managed not to goof it up.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's like some of the management theorists talk about employees. You know, everybody comes to a new job with their own motivation, and what most companies do is they screw it up for them in the first 3 to 6 months with Mickey Mouse regulations and with, you know, condescending bosses and so forth. You know, we've got to be the opposite, where when people come to us with great levels of enthusiasm, we don't screw that up. We keep them with high enthusiasm. Hey, this has been phenomenal. I know we could go on this subject all day, but let's chat about one other thing. On a minute by minute basis, if you were coaching a school owner, and we both do this quite a bit, coaching a school owner how to get out of their own way and to truly make the leap from being a hobbyist who's struggling to highly successful school owner, where would you start? What would be the first two or three activities you would take to do that?
I want to check their schedule, first of all. I want to make sure that they are working a full day. I want to make sure they're getting to their school at 8:30 or 9:30 or somewhere in there, and that they are micromanaging a lot of the details of their school during the times when there are no classes there.
Mm-hmm.
You and I know there's a lot of karate school owners that just show up for classes. And I think it really takes more than that. You know, I think for an hour in class, it takes about an hour out of class to manage all the information and to make sure that the relationships are good. And so I want to make sure that that guy is working a real day, because especially when you are on the upside of your career, when you are trying to incur that initial growth, I think it, you know, if you and I look back at our salad days in this, we were working a lot of long days, weren't we?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't think we worked them quite the same way we used to. We're both hard workers, but, you know, in that initial phase.
Speak for yourself.
Well, in that initial phase, it takes a lot more time, I think, than a lot of people expect it to. And so I want to check an owner's schedule right from the start to make sure that they're putting in an adequate amount of time.
Well, you know, that's a good point. And you know, I'll tell you a couple things. One is, we see over and over and over again school owners who think they can show up at school at 5 and leave at 8 and then can't figure out why they're not performing at a high level. And, you know, and I know in my own case, I mean, and as you know, I've been juggling a lot of plates for 26 years, but when I was actually in running a school myself, if I showed up at the school at 3 or 4 o'clock and just hit the ground running when classes were going on, way too many things dropped through the cracks.
Right.
And, you know, and of course, in the day and age that we're in right now, you know, I mean, truthfully, you need 20 hours a week to be marketing to get new students.
Right.
And you probably need another 20 hours a week to be keeping track of students and to be organizing curriculum and to be organizing events and all of the other stuff that's necessary to ensure proper retention and proper achievement.
Right.
So yeah. That's a good starting point.
I guess what I would say next is that you have to be a person who's constantly developing staff, even if you're not hiring that staff right then. But you and I both know a school is nothing more than a staff. Your facility doesn't matter. Your location doesn't matter. It all comes down to the people that are working in it. And a lot of times people expect that they're going to somehow attract this large body of students, but they're not good at attracting a small body of potential employees.
Yeah.
And, you know, the same principles of attraction work with your employees that are in play with your students. And so you've got to be building a team, even if you don't need that team yet. Somehow you've got to be collecting more people than yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and said a different way, and see if you agree with this, is what I've often told school owners is that one of the fallacies that they have is that they end up with too many people on payroll, but none of them paid particularly well.
Right.
And truthfully, I think what you and I have always wanted is we've always wanted very high-quality people who could be compensated at a very high level. Relative to their capability, and I know you've had it all in the family, oftentimes, which is wonderful. But the it's very important to have the highest quality people, and to really be focused on making sure that you're compensating them well. I see a lot of school owners who really think that they can get people to volunteer. And to not be paid or not be paid adequately, and it's really kind of scary the way they view it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yep.
So, what would be two other things that you'd look for in developing a staff that's going to be interacting with your students?
I want to see good systems in place.
Yeah.
That are easily replicated. Here's how we answer the phone.
Yeah.
Here's what to do when we register an introductory program. Here's how the belt system works. Here's when we put the stuff in the computer. That the systems are solid and followed and executed well by the staff, even if the staff just happens to be a one-person owner. But that systems are in place. A lot of times people are doing things haphazardly.
Yeah.
Fred does it this way, and when Susan comes in, she does it a different way. Any business that's successful has to own its own systems. And I think a lot of times people have neglected to sit down on paper and pen and say, how does this thing work, and get those systems carefully put into place.
You bet. You know, in our case, of course, we've developed those over 25, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's really, really only two ways to go about that, wouldn't you say? I mean, one is to truly become a student of the industry, to delve in, to attend mastermind meetings, to really read and listen to interviews like this, really get into the mindset of other people who've done what they want to do, such as the two of us, and to really delve into that. Obviously, the other way is like what we're doing with My Life Karate is, you know, plug into a system that's truly complete A to Z. And I did I think you remember, Tim Kovar went along with me for a bunch of these. I did little seminars all over the country, from L.A. to New York and Seattle. And what I came to think of it is that, most of the industry fit into one of two categories. They were either oblivious, obviously not the people who are on this call, or they have been hit with so many different things and so many different systems that they have a hodgepodge of stuff. So they had pulled, personality's little way of doing age appropriate curriculum, and then somebody else's marketing idea and somebody else's sales idea and a different thing, and all of a sudden they had this hodgepodge of stuff, and any one of the ideas might have been fine, but by the time it was all done they had this mishmash of stuff that really didn't work.
It's like trying to cook something using a bunch of different recipes.
Well, that's right. That's right. You know, going to a cookbook and pulling the recipe off page 22 and 48 and 72 and mixing and matching and then hoping it all works out well. And that's what I was finding, is an awful lot of people hadn't developed a congruent system that truly worked and everything worked together. Not that there was anything wrong with any piece, although we both know some of the pieces, never did work. There clearly are people in the industry who are good at marketing their stuff, but not particularly good at having something that really works. But what would you say to that? I mean, I know you've seen a lot of people, and we've interacted with some of the same guys who have piecemeal things.
Uh-huh. It's really something that is one of the other changes that's taken place in the martial arts, is that now it is easy to plug into systems, because there are systems that are proven to work. But I think back to the early 1980s, and certainly when I first opened a martial arts school, their systems were just not in place. There were not things to learn to do, because the martial arts was new as an industry. If I had opened a restaurant in the 1970s, there were decades and decades of pieces of information about how to run a restaurant. But the work in systems for martial art businesses started with Jun Ri and Mr. Kokinas and people like yourself way back then. And so who knew how to run a black belt program or how to develop a staff back in those days? And so we were really searching back then to try to figure out what was the right way. Now I guess the challenge is a little bit different, because not only is there a way, there are a lot of different ways that have to be chosen among. But I do think that it's important to identify the source. And a lot of, I think it's time for school owners to become wiser consumers of information, because you make a great point that you're going to have a mess if you take these things piecemeal. But if you look at the different systems that are available and look at the different people that are offering advice, I think the nature of that advice varies from person to person. And I think when you become clear about what your outcome is with your school, and what I mean by that is what kind of lifestyle you're trying to produce, which is the ultimate goal of the school owner, is not to be profitable, but to be profitable and to have the kind of lifestyle you want. I think that there's a clue in that that would tell you which systems are right for you to follow.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, an awful lot of it, I think, is also making a decision about, whether some school owners design their curriculum based upon what they're personally excited about learning at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to your line that you're teaching people, not curriculum. And the curriculum is a methodology to get somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's very useful to decide first what type of people you want to be teaching. In other words, what demographic, what psychographic, what type of people you want to be surrounded with, what will make your life comfortable, what will be the type of people that you'll find rewarding to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And then figure out what you want the outcome with them to be, more so than what you want technically to be teaching them, and then piece it together from there.
Those kind of choices are so important as they relate to the owner's lifestyle, because you and I have seen it before, haven't we, where somebody builds a successful school that they hate and they can't wait to get out from under it. And then it either collapses or they get into something else, or, you sacrifice lifestyle in the beginning, but the farther you go and the more you accomplish, I think the more you have to take control over the choices that you're making to really kind of develop the sort of lifestyle that you want. And you and I have both, we've both been blessed by having the success that's empowered us to do that.
Absolutely. Well, and a conversation that you weren't a part of, I've probably related to you before, but I remember Steve LaValle in a parking lot fairly late at night. I forget where we were. I think it was in Chicago, and it was when you were, you know, probably had just done 60,000 net that month. And he had said to me, he said, "Wouldn't we both be better off to just go do one big school like what Keith is doing?" And you know, and of course, his perspective was, is, you know, we wouldn't have to, you know, be working as hard as what we're working, and we can make more money and so forth. And my comment to him at the time, this is probably 10 years ago, is I said, well, it all depends on what your goals and objectives are.
Yep.
And if your objective is to do the sales and to have a high net income and to be in a consistent mode of that, then that would be a way to do it. If your goal is to have, you know, an operation that's spread out with lots of people running and spending, I mean, obviously it's a more complicated conversation than that, but you know, ultimately it's the Covey thing. You know, Steve Covey talks about, you know, people climb the ladder of success to realize the ladder was propped up against the wrong wall.
Uh-huh.
Is you've really got to be careful what you build. I know in when it comes to multi-schools, you know, I found that out as I got more and more employees, I figured out that wasn't exactly what I wanted to have created, and that's why we went to this master franchise structure that we're doing.
Uh-huh.
So we can help people develop 20 schools, but with one or two employees rather than with 100 of them.
Right.
And more recently, by the way, Dave Cover and I were talking, and he came across the same conclusion. You know, they peaked at like 120 employees and figured out that may not have been the best strategy for lifestyle and income.
Yep.
Well, hey, Keith, we have chewed up a lot of your time, and I certainly appreciate it. Any last points that we should make for everybody before we ring off today?
Well, there sure are. You didn't finish the lobster story.
Oh, the rest of the lobster story. That's right. Well, you know, what happened is, I forget how many years it was, but you know, we had pegged your school against one of my schools.
Uh-huh.
And the deal was whoever had the highest numbers at the end of the year would buy the other guy lobster.
Uh-huh.
And so I kicked your ass the first year, kicked your ass the second year. By the third and fourth year, we felt kind of bad about reminding you of the of the bet we had. And then you made your decision to go from a good small school to a big school, and by the I think the fifth year of the bet, and again, neither one of us had ever exchanged a lobster at this point. By the fifth year of the bet, my best school had done about half of what your school had done at the end of the year. And finally, I felt bad, even though you owed me about four lobsters. So we were at a meeting. I recall it was in Fort Lauderdale because we were at this meeting, and we were going to reconvene the next morning. And so after we had finished dinner, I went to a grocery store and bought a live lobster and put the live lobster in the bathtub. And, of course, I'm not much on lobster care, so the poor thing expired overnight. And so I had this vision of coming into the meeting and having this live lobster bouncing around on the plate, and instead I ended up with this like 20-pound lobster, whatever it was, recently expired on the plate. And finally we exchanged the lobster, although I think with our lobster bet neither one of us actually ate a lobster.
Now, just so everybody knows, this was a beautiful conference room with 10 EFC board of directors sitting around it, including Mr. Kokinas, and the big lobster is ceremoniously brought into the room and plopped down on the middle of the conference table and proceeded to stink up the entire meeting.
Well, it was designed to be this live lobster comes in and crawls around to the table, and unfortunately it expired overnight in the bathtub, so it ended up being this, you know, recently dead lobster that was stinking up the table in the middle of the board meeting. I recall that was one of the many ways that I got in trouble in that meeting environment.
Now, for the people that are listening to this, just so that they know that gentlemanly competition still exists, you and I have another bet. We're not going to tell everybody what it is, but you and I have another bet that we're both working on, don't we?
We do, although I have to say my acquisition of NAPNA put you in the lead on that one.
That's all right. I'm not setting any records either, but it's just good for everybody to know that we still have gentlemanly competition.
That's right. And my reward for winning that bet is the embodied in the model that I have sitting here on my desk. Mm-hmm. So I have a red Ferrari model here. So you know, if I actually break down and buy the red Ferrari, you'll know that I accomplished the objective that we've set on that one.
Well, you may very well do that.
Well, very good. Thank you, Professor Hafter.
My pleasure.
The Sounds of Success is produced in Clearwater, Florida. It is intended exclusively for members of the National Association of Professional Martial Artists and their staffs.